Okay, anything is fair game to ask. You don't have to clean up anything. And I'll repeat the questions after I hear them. Okay? Yes. With what? Siddhima? You mean Maharaji Siddhima? My current relationship, when Maharaji, my guru, left his body, he had been keeping a diary for years of all the critical things that were happening each day. You wouldn't think gurus would do that, but when you opened his diary, what he had written two pages of each day was Ram, 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 because God just kept happening. So he handed those books over to her and told her she should keep them now. So, and she's a beautiful, great village woman, a very, very deep and wise person. So she is my guru sister, I would say. Okay. Questions? Behind me, yeah. Yeah.
I've just done a little bit of substitute teaching in the public schools, and I'm not teacher trained. And I find myself in agony between what I call the expectation of being a tool of the system, quote, and wanting to be there for the kids in some way that's real and that's deep and that I can really serve. But they're already, you know, so resistant, and there's so much going on in the interaction. How to understand and use that in a way that works?
Got it. Good question. Do you hear it? You didn't hear the question. She is substitute teaching, and she finds a tremendous unbearable tension in herself between representing the system as it exists to honor her contract to fulfill a role and being there for the children in the way she understands it. And she feels that the kids have already been trained in such a way, so they're even resistant to that. Okay, there's a good example. If you are on the curriculum of awakening, this is a juicy one to work with. Really juicy. Okay? Because it's clear that that tension between the two of those things rips you apart. And to find the place in you where you can hold the values and then see the reality of what is and do what you can to bridge that gap by your being, by the work you do on yourself as you're offering to those kids. And then what happens is in the hands of God. It's not your business. Okay? So it becomes a vehicle for you, right? To when you meet somebody who is busy being in their role, like the kids are, and you want to meet them as a fellow soul. Huh? And they're what? They're out to get you. The game is changing a bit. I just get the little buggers. I don't... I'll tell you, if they're out to get you, that's the projection of their minds. And if their minds are clearer than yours, they got you. And if they aren't, they don't. So don't be a lazy slob. Get on with it. Don't expect genteel responses from me tonight. I'm in a feisty mood. Questions? Yes. Okay. She wants to deal with anger. She wants to deal with anger. She's an angry driver. She's an angry driver. Well, the interesting question is whether your anger helps anything or not. And if it doesn't, it's a lot of bullshit and you're spending too much time feeding it. The best thing to do is just give it up. You know, when my guru said that to me, he said, Ram Dass, give up your anger. Trained as I was as a psychologist, you don't just give up your anger. You might cathartic. You might work it out. You might punch a pillow. You might punch your teacher. You might do any number of things. You can hate your parents, but you've got to work it out. My guru said, give it up. And it was bizarre. So then he said an interesting thing. He said, give it up, give a little up each day and I'll help you. And what I've seen is every time I get angry, it's like for me now diving from air into water. It's like going into a thicker medium. I don't even know it's anger yet. It could be lust. They often seem like, you know. So, well, whatever it is, it's something, and I'm getting caught in identifying with an attitude, an opinion, a desire, an attachment, an aversion, something. And it's no fun. And I just know, now, I just want to get out of it. I don't want to figure out whether I should get out of it. I already did that. Now I'm just going to activate whatever thing I need to get out of it. Okay? Sir. How do you deal with the issues of karma and there being no self? This is a sort of a technical question. But as I look around, I'm not sure who else is here, so I will answer it technically. In the way in which I'm defining ego soul awareness, as a Buddhist, I realize that the soul is a transitory thing. I am using it as a stepladder in a vehicle to go from identification with separateness to non-identification with separateness, non-exclusive identification. So the nice thing about soul is you can go into soul and really realize you're looking at the universe from a different place without having to give up your separateness. A lot of people are a little frightened about giving up their separateness, like everybody. You know? So, karma is the soul's karma. What's continuous about souls over their time span, whatever that may be, whether it's just a flick of a thought, however long that is, the uniqueness of it is karma. It's like a DNA code. And it leads the soul to manifest over and over again in some way or other, on the dream state, on the physical plane, on some place or other. And then the karma gets worked out slowly by the manifestation. The soul, if you get lost in the manifestation, you think you're working it out. If you're the soul, you see it's working it out. All right? Just like if I have a cut, I watch and watch, then say it's healing. I don't have to heal it. Okay? Am I dealing with your question? That's karma. And as far as I can see, form and emptiness. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form, and in that sense, self is no other than non-self, and non-self no other than self. So, I can use illusions to get rid of other illusions, knowing I'm going to throw all the illusions away. Okay? Yes. The root of all fall. The root of all false mysticism is the desire for experience. Well, I guess all I can go as far as is saying that desire for experience is one of the roots of false mysticism. But I have no idea whether it's the root or not. I can't quite go that far because I haven't really reflected on it. Okay? I don't question Thomas Merton. I mean, who would dare do that? Yes. Yeah? She's asking about moving towards holarchy or sort of equi-power distribution as opposed to vertical power? And where am I in that? Isn't that the question? What's my feeling? What's my feeling? Well, here's the thought, and the feeling seems okay. The thought is that when you and I were trained and acculturated, we did that all through relationships with other beings. So we are basically, our ego structure is really totally relational. The way we think of who we are, it's in relationship to things and people around us. And at some point, we threw over our membership in communities because of some model in our minds that, first, a confusion between external freedom and internal freedom, and second, a feeling that individual, that I had to go my own trip, that the journey to enlightenment is for each individual, and what you have to do is throw off membership and things. So there has been breakdown in the extended family. There has been breakdown in a lot of the membership in social structures that gave your ego life meaning. Now, we got so far over in what do I want, what do I need. You go into another culture, like I go to India all the time. We're in the villages of India. They live with role identity, not personality identity. They fulfill their roles. I'm not arguing from it as whether it's bad or good. That isn't the issue. The issue is these people are identified with role, not personality. They don't ask, what do I want, what do I need? They ask, what's my part to play? What's my dharma? What's my dharma? And then you come back to our culture, and it looks like the backward of a mental hospital. I mean, everybody is, I'm not getting enough. I want more. I need. I had a terrible childhood. You don't understand. I deserve. I mean, it's so painful. It's so thick. And everybody walks down the street telling you this is who they are. And everybody, I mean, it's like a victimized society. It's a bizarre thing. And this is all psychodynamic stuff, you know. And I don't think that's interesting enough, basically. I mean, I think personality is kind of fun, you know, to play with. But to get caught in it is such a drag. Really, it's just not interesting enough. So I would say that there has been an awakening for me to the fact that I was so caught in individualism that I was losing my sense of community. And when my father was too old and I took care of him for many years, I wasn't the primary caretaker, but I made sure everything was all right and gave that whole scene a lot of stability for about 10 years. During that time, I watched my own consciousness go from the first thing when I was the one that moved into the house to take care of Dad. Everybody said, isn't he good to be doing that? See, you can hear that, where it comes from. And I milked it. See, I'd say, well, somebody has to do it. See, and I was busy being righteous. Well, I'll tell you, that lasted a few years and they get worn out. See, whatever scenario you think is going just isn't interesting enough. And so we got to the point where I decided taking care of Dad was my yoga. Dad, you're my yoga. Turn over, you know. And we ran out of that one. And then we got into a place where there was just the shitting and the cleaning up the shit. There was the feeding and the wiping, and there was there was just the dance being done, and nobody really gave a damn who was doing it. And I suddenly realized I'd come home into something that I had been so busy pushing away. I mean, he was a different generation. How could he understand how I felt about da-da-da? Some of you must have experienced that. And what happened was, as I let go of all these models of him and me and what I thought I was doing and just did it, he changed. And he started to be this absolute, I mean, I never really liked him. And he turned into this really, it was like Buddha. He was just absolutely beautiful. And we'd hold hands and look at the sunset. And he never did that. He never did that. Once we were sitting out on his farm looking at the sunset. And he was looking out, and there, it was all, Dad had a lot of manicured lawns and stuff like that. And he said, "Isn't it beautiful, Rich?" And I said, "Yeah, it sure is." There were purples and oranges. Oh, it was beautiful. He said, "Look at how tightly it's trimmed." See, if he couldn't even get up to the sky, how did I think he was going to get to some other plane? And then there we were. There we were, unexpected, believe me, to both of us, just hanging out together. And people would come in and they'd freak because he wasn't who he used to be. Somebody who didn't like him came in and said, "Hi." And he, my father didn't answer, he just smiled. And the person went out and said, "That bastard still won't talk to me." And my aunt came in, who loved my father, her big brother, and she said, "George, how are you?" And he just smiled at her. And she said, "What have they done to you? Where have they taken you?" He was happy, I was happy, she was miserable. And so what I learned was, in this very natural way of just listening and finding my way through, I found my way back into that kind of whole scene you're talking about, as opposed to vertical, the kind of whole thing. So I feel it like I feel it as I tune in on the internet. I feel it in a lot of ways in which I feel there is a democratization of energy and power and consciousness, and information is so clearly connected with power, and consciousness is better than information. And to the most conscious being go the spoils. So watch out, Bill Clinton. Questions? Yes. Speak about spirituality in the workplace. It always keeps coming back to the same thing. Where are you, by the way? There, okay. It always comes back to the same thing. It's your work on yourself. Because the workplace is just a model in your mind for an existential situation in which you meeting other souls through various skills. Now the question is, do you meet as souls or do you meet only in your roles? You hear what I'm asking? And so your work is to be there in your role and as a soul. And then the other person does whatever they can do. And then you're bringing into that workplace a level of consciousness that allows the whole scene to become more conscious. Without bulldozing anybody. Because that's not going to work, believe me. So one of the things we've done, for example, is we've worked up like about 150-page statement of standards for businesses. Things that say, if I'm an ethical, moral, responsible human being, I really should think a little bit about the community where I'm dumping my waste. You know, it's just little issues like that, you know. And it's interesting to start to help businesses relook at their bottom line in terms of these issues. And I think what is shifting also is the appreciation of the difference between stockholders and stakeholders. And that as we get to look at businesses in terms of stakeholders, we start to appreciate where change can happen much better. Am I dealing with your question? Okay. Sir. What's my perspective on the life of Timothy Leary? How is his journey different than mine? Well, I'll give you a delicious vignette. In this vignette, you've got to understand that Timothy and I both had innumerable consciousness-expanding experiences. But we responded differently to them, undoubtedly because of our karmic predilections. And so Timothy became fascinated with form, and I became more fascinated with formlessness. So you could call me a mystic, and you call him a visionary. So we were different, and he loved thought. And I kind of saw thought as something to be a little free of. So now it's close to his death, and he is downloading his mind into his web page, because that's what a scientific materialist would do. He's also going to freeze his brain, that's the other thing he set up, cryonics, for later when it can be rewired. So I, as a psychologically trained entity, feel that he is caught in his mind, and that when he dies, it's going to be difficult for him because he's made such an investment in something that's going to crumble. So he's ill-prepared because he's in denial. So I better help him. So I go down to help Timothy, but nobody there seems to need help. They're all in virtual reality. I mean, they're in cyberspace. Everybody in the house is in cyberspace, and they're downloading. And they're all downloading everything, and it's incredible. Nobody's dying, so I'm the only one worried about dying. None of them are, so. But I had my little suspicions. But he and I had this whole lifetime tension between these two views. So now he's dying. It's a few days before he's dying. He calls me around 11:30 at night, and he says, "Richard, I think I'm losing my memory." Okay. So I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know," he said, "memory's just about everything." I said, "Yep." So I knew he thought that. He said, "But you know," he said, "there's something more than memory." I thought, aha. It's like a deathbed confession, you know, like, wow. So I said, "Yeah." He said, "But I forgot." I can't ask for a better playmate than that. I want you to know, all right? That's a real playmate. And so the last time I was down there, I was with him, and he was signing blotter art, acid blotter art. I think he got $100 for every signature, and he was practically dead, you know, and he was just like, and I was taking them away as he signed them, and I said, "Timothy, we're doing peace work. You know, this is great." And I saw that he had this whole game around him, and I looked in his eyes, which he never did that much. I looked in his eyes, and who I saw looking back at me was so far behind all of his games. He was so somebody open to the mystery, so much not even trapped in being the adventurer, which is a trap of mind. He was just ready, there. And it completely, all the thing drained out of me, all my psycho paranoia, you know, and I just felt absolutely, go friend, go. And there was one thing he did with his dying that I really want to applaud. He published daily his drug intake. And it was picked up by CNN and Newsweek. So it would say he had so much coffee, so many Dilaudids, so many balloons of nitrous oxide, so many hash cookies, so many of scotch, and so on. And at first I thought, well, he's certainly being showy, you know. But then I saw that he was saying, when you tailor your own drug needs at the time of dying, the way he was choosing to do it was to stay as pain-free as he could, as alert as he could, and have as much fun as he could. See, now that third one, you see how hard that sells in this culture? Have fun dying? Don't be silly. That's obscene. Why? And I love the fact that he played that one out. I just think that's beautiful. As just a statement, a social statement. Timothy was, with predispositions, very much of a revolutionary. He was very busy overthrowing the establishment. And I am very much of an evolutionary, in the sense I sneak in and permeate. And it all changes, you know. I mean, I don't go against. And when we worked together, it was quite exquisite, because we were both, he was very evolutionary, of course, also. But his revolutionary bent of fighting, like the Irish fighting the English, whatever it was that was in him, or the Catholic altar boy, there was a very far out moment near the end. I came to visit him, and I knew about his diet of all his medicines and his consciousness and the pain and the state of the cancer. And I said to him, Timothy, this is a really interesting time. What have you found out? Got anything for me to tell the troops, you know? And he said, well, the first thing I found out is, and I really leaned forward to get this one, he said, is that I'm a good boy. Isn't that tasty? I mean, that's all. I just want to share that. Yeah. That's a big one. Yeah. Let me just make sure I'm getting the round here. Yes, way back. Woman? Yes. A youth suicide rate? Yeah. Well, I think that first of all, I think that death and sex are much closer together in cultural consciousness than they ever were before. And I think that kids feel often very, very cut off from the whole structure of the society in which they're living. Everybody, family, friends, everybody. And I think they're starving to death in their minds. And then they really want to escape that space. And because it's unbearable to be that cut off, to be that hungry. And most people either try to break their way out of it forward or make do with very little. But some people just say, I can't play. I can't stand it. I mean, it may well be that the person is a very evolved being and is just dropping their body. And it's not like they're dying at it inappropriately, because since you don't know really what we're doing here, it's hard to figure out whether a child killing himself knows something you don't, or is making a terrible error. See, and it's very presumptuous in a way to act as if you do know when you don't know. I mean, sometimes I look at childhood deaths and I feel with the culture the pain of a young life not living out its dreams. But then a kind of little rascally part of my mind says, imagine we're all here in the fourth grade. We've all been born into the fourth grade, and somebody comes along and says, you're going on to the fifth grade early. And everybody in the fourth grade says, no, no, don't leave us. You're so young. And the other person's only going to the fifth grade. And I get a feeling at times that we are so enamored of where we think we are that we're not really, that it colors our judgment about how long people should live. I really have a sense that, and my guru said this at one point, nobody dies a minute too late or a minute too soon. Now I have to figure out why it could happen to that person at that moment. You know, or feel it and understand it in my heart. But not judge it. Not judge it. Yeah. Yes? I think you change a stigma by not holding it. That's the first thing you do. And if you're even against the stigma, it's got you. So it's a lot to get beyond stigma, to just be with the person behind the stigma. That's really what you're doing. But for you to do that, you've got to get beyond the stigma or your reaction to it. It's interesting. Questions? Sir? Oh, man. Aha. Uh-huh. How do you keep your center when everybody around you is losing theirs or has lost theirs? Well, I'll tell you, what you usually do is you pick battles you can win now and then, and you don't go near the really heavy things unless you have to. And if you have to go near them, you usually drown for a while, and then you sputter to life again. And realize you've gotten caught in this stuff. And you just barely hold on, and then you start to get stronger again. That's usually what happens. Once you understand what this process of this curriculum of awakening is about, then that situation is like Kali has come with her tongue dripping blood to purify you. And you'd say, oh, wow, instead of being surrounded by satsang or sangha, I'm surrounded by total illusion. I remember the moment when I'd been thrown out of Harvard. And there was a press conference because I was the first person in 6,000 years to be thrown out of Harvard. And the press was surrounding me, the television, the radio, and they were all looking at me like I was a loser because I had taken on Harvard and lost. And I felt like somebody who had lost a big fight and would now be sweeping the gym. But the predicament was that inside myself, I felt like I'd won. And I said, because I was now connected with this deeper spiritual truth in my being. And I said to myself, the psychologist in me said, that is psychosis. When everybody thinks one way and you think another way, you should give yourself a second opinion. And I turned out to be right. I thought, if it's psychosis, here we go. Because you can't deny your inner truth just because it happens to be psychotic at a cultural moment in history. Because what psychosis in one moment is sainthood in another. Not always, but... Questions? Sir? The practice of meditation in my life. The more deeply I became involved in the journey of awakening, the more I began to see the predicament I was in relation to my own mind. and see that I was incredibly trapped in identification with my thoughts, my desires, my stuff. And it was in that appreciation that I first started to enter into meditation as a practice that promised that if I would use some discipline in undertaking it, it would help me extricate my awareness from identification with my thought. Not to deny the thought, but not to be trapped by it. Okay? So I went into, at that time, Theravadan Buddhism, Vipassana meditation. Very simple, following your breath, rising and falling, following your steps, lifting, pushing, putting place. And I developed some samadhi or concentration. And then you take that concentration and you start to examine your mind with that concentrated mind. And you start to break through into other levels of awareness. And this just happens with discipline of pursuing one of these paths. What happened was, over years, I've practiced very many different kind of meditation strategies. And I'm a kind of an eclectic, dilettante, you know, jerk. But what I found is that every one of them worked with another part of my being and helped me. I could see that each one started to have a payoff for me. And I started to be much more interested in a whole lot of other kinds of meditation practices, many more devotional, a lot of different kinds. Am I dealing with your question? Yes? The soul is the ocean that thinks it's a soul. The thought that it is a soul is what reincarnates. Okay. I mean, it's still a drop in the ocean, so it's still whatever it is. It just isn't, you don't stand inside of it any longer. You're the whole ocean. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. I didn't turn. Isn't that nice? Well, who are the U-turns to? I mean, you're watching it all. But that's their problem. What are you upset about? Well, as you do inner work through whatever method you do, you become different. It's not like you have something, it's you are something. Or you open to a deeper part of what you are. And that isn't exactly takeable away, because it's what you are, right? That's their problem. If you get caught in it, that's your problem. You're saying, I get caught in their judgments of me. Because I'm trying to convince them I'm right, you said. I would say you hold what you believe and be what you believe. One of my friends called from a mental hospital and he said, you know I'm the Buddha. He said, but when I tell my mother that, she's not the least bit appreciative. But he said, when I am the Buddha, she really likes it. Okay. Yes.
Please flip the tape now and begin side B.